I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. More than half of Vermont's registered facilities providing residential care for older Vermonters have had significant problems in maintaining adequate care for the people they're charged with caring for. A joint investigation by VPR and 7Days analyzed more than 5 years' worth of documents to try to get a sense of where there were violations, what kind of violations are being reported, and what this means for families relying on these assisted living and residential care homes. Their reporting shows scores of facilities have failed to meet some of the most basic state requirements, and at least 5 residents have died because of deficient care in the last 6 years. The number of people who may have died less directly from inadequate care and safety is unknown. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the problem and what's being done to address it with 2 reporters from the project. Emily Corwin is an investigative reporter for VPR, and Derek Brower is a reporter for 7Days, and they join us now. Derek and Emily, thanks for being with us today, and thanks for your reporting.
Hi, Jane.
Yeah, hi, Jane.
So let's talk a little bit first about what the overarching issue is. You've done all of this work and you have months of reporting and analysis and documents in your brains. But if you just have to put the headline up or the, you know, one paragraph summary of what the problem is, what is it? Emily?
So essentially, the oversight system that looks at the facilities that are doing care. They're called residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, and these are state licensed, unlike nursing homes that are licensed by the feds. They have minimal regulations. And essentially what we found is that people have very, very little access to the information about what's going on in these homes, which the state already knows. So on the one hand, it's a matter of, you know, us finding patterns of inadequate care, like you mentioned, at least 5 people whose deaths are related, tied to that inadequate care in some way, a lot of injuries resulting, and the fact that consumers don't have access to that information. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that, you know, the whole system designed to oversee these facilities is also very minimal. And so there's just not a ton of scrutiny.
So, Derek, I mean, people who have a loved one in a facility like this or maybe are either thinking of going to a place that can help them live independently or live less independently if they need that, or people who are in these facilities already who are listening, what do they do immediately? I mean, is there the sense that pull your loved one out now from anywhere in Vermont that is a facility, or is there sort of a tempered idea of what your findings show that you know, this sort of take action or don't take action moment that people are going to have in their guts and hearts when they hear what Emily just said?
Right. I mean, these are already really tough decisions for seniors and their families to begin with. And I don't think my place to tell anyone what to do. However, what I hope that our reporting can provide is enough information that families and residents can ask better questions of the facilities that they're considering or may already be in, and can find the information they need to better understand what problems a facility may have experienced in the past, may be currently experiencing, so they can either watch out for those or make more informed decisions generally.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's one of the key parts of your reporting and one of the key parts of your co-conspirator, co-reporter on this, data reporter, Andrea Suazo, who's done a lot of work and made this database that we'll talk about in more depth coming up, so that people actually can check what violations have happened at facilities. Because, Emily, that wasn't something they could do through the state prior to your reporting.
That's right. So while the inspection reports are posted by the state online, they're really hard to get to. They're on a sort of obscure website. They're posted in very unsearchable fashion. They're just PDFs. So we've got this database, which you can actually go now. It's called a navigator. It's on our website. So you can go and you can search for a facility and sort of see how it fits in a constellation of facilities, the range of care that's happening. You can learn more. You can access easily the documents that the state does make public, but which had been previously much harder to find.
Derek, is there a pattern in terms of where you are seeing violations, either geographically or by the type or size of facility?
Yeah, I'd start by zooming out for a second. One of the impetuses for this project was the well-publicized problems at a series of homes known as the Pillsbury Homes in the Burlington area. This was last fall, and just to briefly summarize what had happened in that instance was the company, it was a private equity firm out of Texas that had recently bought the facilities, had stopped cashing rent checks, which was scaring residents to begin with, and then in turn weren't paying food vendors, other vendors, and food was running short, the caregivers were running short, and it really became a crisis situation and the state stepped in. So in the wake of that, I think the obvious question was, is this one freak incident or are there conditions that that put other homes at risk for these sorts of problems? And that's a complicated answer, but I think what we found is that the problems within the industry are really not confined to any particular type, whether that's by size, ownership, or a category of facility, assisted living or residential care home. We really found problems across the board, and I think that's in part because of some of the systemic challenges that elder care faces, both Vermont and nationally.
What about in terms of the cost of the facility to the residents? Is there any pattern showing that lower cost facilities or facilities taking more public dollars have more violations versus ones that might charge a high premium, at least in theory, for higher quality care and more perks? I mean, are there differences in terms of that?
We didn't do a specific analysis to compare that. However, what I can say is that even the most premier facilities in the state in terms of cost, and some of these are charging $9,000-$10,000 a month, these private pay facilities, and they have pretty impressive amenities, piano rooms, impressive chandeliers in the dining rooms. They had hundreds of violations, including some that caused serious injury and some that really left, I think, us scratching our head as to how that could happen at these facilities as well. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there are very small facilities in Vermont that house 5 to 10 people, many of whom, or all of whom in some cases, rely on Medicaid funding to finance their care. And those facilities, likewise, we've seen had in some cases, poor track records, whether isolated problems or systemic problems that lasted, took in some cases a year or more to resolve.
And we should say, you found in your reporting that 8 facilities had no violations at all, and 60 facilities had only minor violations, not ones that would be considered major violations and really putting the safety of residents at severe risk. Emily, it's important to talk about all of these data points and all of the information that you've gotten. But of course, these are real people, real families. You talked to many families for your reporting, and I'd love it if you could share one story with us just to give us a sense of, what kind of emotions and, real lives we're dealing with as you look at this reporting.
Yeah. So first of all, I just want to say to listeners that the anecdotes I'm about to tell, they're pretty bad. And honestly, having looked at all of this, I think that they stand out as an outlier for the degree of harm that was done. So I just don't want to scare people.
Some people may not want to listen. If
that's
this is
true.
Too close to you, it may be something that isn't going to be working for you.
So I want to tell you about a woman named Marilyn Kelly. She lived at our house, too, which is one of a series of homes in Rutland County. And her daughter, June Kelly, is the eldest of 7. And June is a law enforcement officer. She lives in Brandon. And she decided, along with her siblings, to move her mom to this facility when her mom her dementia was making her behave erratically. And they were afraid for her safety. Dementia can make people difficult. And we should say that up front. And that's very common for people with dementia to sort of become more difficult to handle and negotiate with. And so they brought her to our house, who, specializes in dementia care. And as she and her siblings would visit, they would find her often tired, sometimes in a stupor. And this was an active woman. She was going fishing before she went went there. And at first, June, you know, she thought it was her mom's dementia that was to blame.
Sitting here thinking it's the dementia. I mean, I literally am having conversations. Is she changing that much from the dementia?
That's June Kelly there. And, you know, she says she would talk to the staff at our house and they would also say, yeah, that is the dementia. That's what's happening. But it turns out that's not what was happening. So the facility was putting Marilyn on an antipsychotic called Haldol. It's a sedative. And they would crush the medication 3 times a day. For 50 days, they would put it in her food and drink often. And June Kelly says her family had no idea.
There was no discussion about putting mom on Haldol. There was no discussion about the implications of what Haldol would do to our loved one. It was not like nothing.
And I should say here that, you know, we did talk to Paula Pittorti, the owner of our house, and she, you know, said that she's very passionate about her work, but that she couldn't talk about this particular incident. But in the meantime, there were other things that were worrying June. She said that her mom was often unbathed. She said that a tooth had gone rotten. And there were citations for some of these things in the record as well. And so she says, you know, she's talking to everyone. She's talking to her friends who have parents in these facilities. And this is what happened.
I said to my friend, I go, where are you going to find a place that is safe? And she's like, it's everywhere. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
And, you know, so from there, things get worse. You know, 7 months after moving in, a caretaker actually assaulted Marilyn, who was 78 years old at the time, and she pushed her to the floor and left. And, you know, I've seen the security footage. It's not pretty, but that wasn't even the end of it for this family. Just 2 weeks later, after the assault, the family went to our house too, and they found their mom unattended on a couch in the hallway, and she was struggling to breathe, and she actually had pneumonia. But it seems like nobody had noticed, and so the family rushed her to the hospital, and ultimately that's where she died. And the reason we have so much information about that is because June Kelly's family has filed a lawsuit, has been in litigation actually for some years now. You know, she really wants things to change. She would like to see the state have more oversight, and she really wants to see this facility held responsible for what she considers to be really negligent care.
And did the facility respond at all in your reporting?
So I did talk to Paula Pittorti. She felt that because of the lawsuit, she really couldn't speak to these issues. Like I said, she really emphasized that she is passionate about her work and that they believe that they are doing a good job.
You know, it's interesting too, Emily, in your story, June Kelly says, you know, I'm not sure I even really blame the person who pushed my mom. And you spoke to how difficult care is to sometimes provide for people. But she said, I just want it to change. I want it to be better. But there's not a lot of ill feeling toward particular people and particular workers. And I found that really striking. It's worth listening to that story to hear more of it. So when we see these violations, when they come through, when they're reported to the state, Derek, what is the response from the state to these violations?
So the system that Vermont has set up is built around, and this is a technical term, but it's what they call a plan of correction. And essentially, the state points out the problem, the violation, and the facility in most cases submits an explanation of how they plan to fix it. Now, if it's a particularly serious violation, those in which the state determined that a resident may have been harmed by the poor care, the state may follow up on site to make sure that the plan of correction has in fact been implemented. So that's the basic framework. The state also has the authority under certain conditions to impose sanctions on homes to try to protect residents further. Those include, for instance, banning admissions on a home until they fix a problem or levying fines against them. But I think one of the more surprising things that we learned during the course of our investigation was how rare those sorts of steps are for the state to take. In the last five, almost 6 years, the state has levied only 6 fines against homes, totaling less than $100,000. That is far less frequently than nursing homes, for instance, are fined by the feds. And similarly, only a handful of times has the state imposed an admissions ban. So what that means is that in most cases, there really isn't any consequence for the home other than this ding on their inspection reports, which most consumers don't even know how to find.
So, Derek, do you think the state is failing in its responsibility?
I think we spoke to the long-term care ombudsman for Vermont, Sean Londergan, and he actually called out the regulatory system earlier this year in his annual report. It was the first time that the ombudsman's office had really stated such in their this sort of call for change explicitly. And what he said was that the system has alarmingly little accountability and oversight in the state. So I think there are some people who are calling for some change. And it certainly seems like from our reporting that there is some room for more aggressive oversight. However, it doesn't appear to really have been on policymakers' radar.
Today, we're learning more about the system of caring for aging Vermonters and why and how that system breaks down. Our guests, 7 Days reporter Derek Brower and VPR's Emily Corwin, have been reporting extensively on this for the joint reporting project Worse for Care. You can find all of their reporting by going to vpr.org. Wendy's calling in from Middlesex. Hi, Wendy.
Yeah, hello. Good afternoon. I would like to just say that I have 2 parents at an assisted living in Vermont, and they've been there for about 7 years. When they first moved in, it was a small Vermont-run organization, and then it got bought up by a huge regional New England corporation. The food went downhill, the care went downhill, and it's been really difficult working with this sort of big for-profit, big corporate situation.
Yeah, Wendy, thanks for sharing your thoughts. And, you know, interesting, Derek, to hear Wendy's experience, and certainly in terms of communication and in terms of some of the services that her parents are getting. But in terms of what you found by violations, it's not really, there's no discrimination between a big for-profit care organization and a smaller one. You found violations all across the board?
Well, we did, but I think it's not surprising to hear Wendy's comment. And as we went through the complaints that were being lodged with the state, this was a common refrain for some of these facilities that were purchased or changed ownership, that there was a sense from those complaining that the owners were more distant from the care and had less personal investment or stake in it and were cutting corners as well. And I think I don't doubt what Wendy is saying is true there. I think that's a real concern. I have another story in the series coming out next week on this ownership question. And Vermont, I think regulators in Vermont, even at least policymakers, I should say, are proud to an extent of how many of these homes are still locally owned, small Vermont kind of run businesses, in contrast to nursing homes, which are in large part have been corporatized. But Vermont has still had experiences with the challenges that can come from corporate ownership. And there's one home that I'm writing about for next week where it was the day it was built, it was sold to a real estate investment trust in Florida, and it became functionally it was aligned on a spreadsheet amongst 30 other homes and could then be bought and sold as a package. And the type of management at that home changed with the whims of whichever investment fund bought the home. And the one I'm thinking of had really serious problems and, in fact, led to the largest fine the state has issued in the last 5 years. So there are certainly
risks.
Do you
want to name
risks.
That place?
Yeah, this facility was built as Spring Village in Essex. After these problems, it rebranded and came under new management, and it is now known as Maple Ridge Memory Care. So this is a specialty dementia unit.
Let's go to Patrick, who's with us from Craftsbury. Hi, Patrick. Go right ahead.
Hey there. Yeah, my girlfriend just recently started working at a nursing home with her LNA licensed nurse assistant is the credentials she has. And I've been hearing a lot on the radio here about, you know, how can lawmakers and legislatures change things? Can there be training? Do they need new laws, fines? And the fact of the matter is that she's working 12, 15-hour days, and the facility's so understaffed, and the facility's trying to get new employees. But the fact of the matter is these people who are really doing some hard work make about $11.50 an hour, $13 an hour. If you really want to solve the problem, you need more staff, and they need to be paid real wages because this work is hard.
Yeah, Patrick, thanks for bringing that up, and thanks for that concern for the people who are doing this work and the hours that they work, the care that they provide, and the wages that they get. And Emily and Derek, that is something that you reported on extensively as well. Emily, you want to chime in?
Sure. I'll just give a little thought here, which is I haven't read the research, but I believe that there's research that actually shows that when you're working multiple jobs, when you're like very stressed out, you are it creates the environment for abuse and neglect that would not otherwise occur. So that's just like one thing that I've learned as I've gone through this process. But the other thing that I should say is that as we've been doing our research, we absolutely appreciate and understand the really unfathomable work and care and just long hours and low pay that goes into caring for people in these homes. And we do not want to sound like we're, blaming those people. But, Derek can speak a lot more to the staffing issue because he had a wonderful story come out on that very subject.
Well, just to the point that you're making, Emily, before we go to Derek, Catherine tweeted at us saying, great reporting, but I would like it if the reporters worked a shift with the caregivers. And, there is that way of feeling very attacked by this reporting if you're working in this field and really trying hard and doing really wonderful, backbreaking sometimes care for older Vermonters.
Our goal is not to do that, but to see to shed light on the system so that the people who are making decisions can make good decisions.
Yeah. And Derek, to that point, there's a sort of systemic failure in the system, not necessarily just on the backs of certainly not all the workers and not even individual workers necessarily.
Yeah, I guess I'd first want to say, Patrick and Catherine make really important points. And one of the things that did come up in our reporting was the sense that this type of work just isn't valued enough as a society. And the way that translates is into, as Patrick pointed out, really quite low wages. The average wage in Vermont for a personal care aide is about $13 an hour. And as he also pointed out, they can be working extremely long hours on these jobs. But some of the staffing issues that we found system-wide, I think this is a known problem in the industry, a known challenge. It's been referred to as a workforce crisis facing the industry. And given that, you would think that it's all the more important that these facilities do what they can to support those workers and make sure that they can weed out those who may not be cut out for the really tough job that it is. But one of the more disturbing things I think that we found in our analysis was that just how common it is for facilities not to take some of these basic steps. For instance, more than 40 facilities of the 133 operating the state were cited for not completing employee background checks before hiring someone. And in some cases, our reporting showed that caregivers who with criminal pasts were able to continue working or find other jobs in the industry because of this, because it wasn't adequately reported or screened on the front end. Additionally, there were 70 facilities, so more than half of all homes were cited for failing to complete the annual required training for employees, which the state requires about 12 hours of annual training to keep up with the requirements of the job. And it's, more than half haven't done that. And as a result, a lot of the most troubling situations we came across involved caregivers who were not properly trained. One that I'm thinking of occurred last year at a facility in Winooski called Our Lady of Providence. It's a nonprofit facility. And there was a woman there who fell and broke her hip while she was being transferred out of bed using a piece of equipment called a Hoyer lift. And the state found that the caregivers who were trying to move her weren't properly trained and didn't know how to use this equipment. And she ultimately died as a result of that fall.
Emily?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this might be a good moment to bring up a person we talked to for this series, which is the former commissioner of Dale, Susan Weary, and she's a geriatric psychiatrist. She works in Maine now.
And Dale, we should mention, is the Department of Disabilities and Independent Living for Vermont.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, so she was pointing out that there are these real pressures. There is, you know, not enough dementia, not enough beds for dementia patients who are very, you know, like have very specific needs, and that this puts a pressure on the state. You know, similarly, there's these pressures around staffing. And so, you know, she articulated this idea that that, you know, it creates a complacency not just among the sort of managers of facilities and owners, but also among the state and the people who are tasked with overseeing them.
People who providers who specialize in memory care consider themselves to be doing a bit of a favor for the state. There is no question but that people living with dementia who have behavioral manifestations, okay, are very difficult to find homes for, to find units for, whatever. And so there is this attitude that because they're willing to do it when, quote, no one else is, that that there should be more forgiveness when deficiencies arise.
And, you know, it was really interesting to talk to Weary about this. She was one of two former regulators who spoke, you know, really strongly about their feeling that, you know, we can do better.
Let's go to Richard, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Richard.
Hello. We brought my father up to Vermont. He was in a facility down in New York, and we found that it was necessary to be closer distance-wise because of a lot of the issues that that are being discussed. I'd like to echo the comments about the staffing and short staffing. That's ultimately what led to my father's death. He was at a local facility, and we were very happy with his care. I mean, just outstanding care. And then they were run by a local, you know, privately owned, and the owner was very involved. And then they sold to a national company, and that has sites all over the East Coast, at least. And the quality of care went downhill, and the short staffing became a problem. And you know, my father broke his hip. He should have had a monitor. He was supposed to have a pad that sounded an alarm if he got up. He didn't have it. They were short-staffed that day, and we were told they weren't short-staffed, and that was upsetting. And then we were asked to pay, while he was away in the hospital, we were asked to pay his rent, which was just crazy. So we moved him out of that facility, and he ended at another local facility where he got excellent care. But really, the change from being locally and privately owned to one of these large national companies made a huge impact on the quality of care.
Well, Richard, thank you for sharing your story, and I'm very sorry to hear about your father. Let's hear from another Richard in West Fairley. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I was in the nursing industry for about 6 years in the 90s, and a lot of these issues that everybody's talking about have been going on for quite a long time. One thing that I really wanted to point out to everybody is that whether it's an assisted living care facility or a full care facility, all the patients are supposed to have a care plan so that the nursing staff, the doctors, physical therapy, OT, and the relatives know exactly what's going on. That story with somebody getting medication with nobody knowing about it is just outrageous and shouldn't be happening. These care plans are updated regularly as the patient progresses or declines, and input is put in by all different staff members to try to help those patients improve and have a better dignity of life at these facilities.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you for that point and turn it over to Emily Korn. But before we do, we have another comment as well from Joanna, who says, for care home residents on the Choices for Care Medicaid program, the state used to fund independent case managers to oversee care. The funding for case managers was stopped several years ago, and residents who were working to manage their care lost that benefit. These case managers were also able to be eyes and ears for what was happening in the residential care homes. Perhaps the state was penny wise and pound foolish in this instance. So there's Joanna talking about a plan that would help do what Richard is talking about, and Richard talking about this idea that there should be a way to have a plan for care so that a situation like the one you talked about earlier with Marilyn, who was given Haldol, and apparently she either didn't know or wasn't competent to understand what was being given to her, and her family wasn't told and says they were unaware that she was being given this medication. So, Emily, what to do about that?
I mean, the thing that really struck me about this caller is that he was talking about care plans, and care plans, it's this bland-sounding bureaucratic word, but failures to update residents' care plans came up so many times. There's 104 facilities in Vermont that have been cited for failing to do this. 42 of those instances were like high severity, meaning they caused harm. These care plans are an essential part of the ability for a facility to respond to an individual's needs and to stay on top of declining health. And it's hard to talk about because a care plan just sounds so, you know, I don't know. But it's actually like a really important recurring failure that seems to be causing many, maybe even, I don't know about most, but like many, many of the instances that we've come across. So I just think it's a really important point. And so thanks for calling in, Richard. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we started with was, what happens if you read this report and you think, is my family affected, or what do I do about trying to figure out my care for the elder years? And Derek, there is this database that I want to make sure we talk about because it's really interesting in terms of how people can search and figure out what's happening at facilities that they're interested in knowing more about. Can you just describe how it works so people can go do it themselves?
Yeah, I mean, this was really a cornerstone of this reporting project that was spearheaded by our data reporter, Andrea Suozo, over at 7 Days. And let me set it up this way. I mean, we've already mentioned that the inspection reports, where you can find some information about these problems at the facilities, are hard to find online. One thing we also learned through our reporting is that the state doesn't put all of them online. And so as many as 20% were missing from the state's website. So even consumers that did know where to look may get an incomplete or misleading picture of a facility's track record. So one of the things I think we wanted to do was provide a really user-friendly way for people who are curious about these homes to get some basic important information about how they've performed in the past. And so this navigator that Andrea created allows you to search by facility or a geographic area that may be close to home and just very quickly pull up a record of the complaints made against the facility, how many of those complaints were substantiated, and then a listing of all of the citations they've been issued along with a code that indicates how severe they were, and then a link to the actual document if you want to go read more. And I think this is one of the things that we heard during the course of a report reporting is an essential tool that doesn't exist. It does exist for nursing homes, but until a few weeks ago did not exist for these state-run facilities.
And now it does.
And now it does.
Emily Corwin is an investigative reporter at VPR. Derek Brower is a reporter for 7 Days. I want to thank you both for sharing your reporting, which is ongoing, with us. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Jane.
Really glad to be here. Thanks.
Their series, Worse for Care, is a joint investigation by VPR and 7 Days. 4 stories have been published so far, and there are more to come, so stay tuned. The collaboration also launched the Vermont Elder Care Navigator, which we've just been talking about. It's a searchable database built by 7 Days data editor Andrea Suazo. Photos for the project are by James Buck. VPR's Mark Davis and Matthew Roy and Candace Page at 7 Days are the editors of the series, and you're going to want to check it all out. You can go to vpr.org and search for Worse for Care. You can also, of course, find it at 7 Days as well.